Please welcome our speaker tonight, Andrea.
The darkness. We all came from the darkness, right? Into the light. I'm Andrea, I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really, really grateful to be here. The last time I was here was December of 2017. Rhubarb Jim was here then, and my father had just passed away, and I was not in a good headspace. But when AA asked me to show up, I show up no matter what, and I do that because I watched countless people do that for years before me. So just to give you a little bit of statistics about me, I'm 61 years old. I've been married, 32 years happily to a non-alcoholic. My son will be 29 this month on the 13th. I have a 25-year-old daughter. And my sobriety date is August 27th, 1984. And I'm very grateful that I haven't had to pick up a drink since. Now, I came in at age 23 in college in Northern California. So you can see the before and after. I was heavily addicted to drugs. I was smoking 2 to 4 packs of cigarettes a day, but it was an all-night party. It was definitely 4 packs, one cigarette after another, and drinking a lot. But I didn't think I was an alcoholic. Big difference. I was at the airport last weekend flying down south for a family wedding, and I was talking to someone. I love animals. I was talking to someone that had one of those pets. I forget what they call them. There's a specific name for the pet. If you have whatever, a care pet, service pet. Thank you. Service pet. And so I was talking to this young gentleman, and we started talking in more hushed voices, and I asked to pet his dog, and then we started talking. I just had intuition because I have a friend I got sober with who's a veteran. And I said, "Are you a veteran?" And he said, "Yes." And we started talking, and he told me how many, wars he was in, and then he bent over and showed me this huge scar on the back of his neck. He goes, "I don't look like a veteran, do I? I don't look like someone that survived, this horrible bomb." And I said, "No, but would you believe I'm a recovered alcoholic and addict?" He goes, "No." And I'm like, we can't judge a book by our covers, right? We can't judge a book by our covers. And so much of the end of my drinking, when I was out there, I was trying to be something I wasn't. Like I wanted, they talk about the actor that we portray in the big book. I wanted to be this. I wanted to be that. I aimed to go out and just have a couple drinks, and be home, before 2 a.m. And next thing I know, it'd be 6 a.m. The sun would be coming up. I've been smoking all night long. I'm with people that I hadn't planned to be with beginning of the evening. And so all these plans and little designs I had for the evening went out the window as soon as I put that first drink in. It just, everything went out the window. And, so for those of you, I guess the only thing I can think of is, So I was raised in Northern California. I'm from just north of San Francisco. Middle class home. Mom and dad seemed normal. They held down jobs. I knew a little bit about alcoholism because my aunt was an alcoholic and my cousins were taken from her. And she was institutionalized and they lived with us for a summer. And I was young enough to see, even though I couldn't name it, that they were affected, emotionally affected, like banging their heads on their beds at night and other things. And so, I picked up on stuff like that. I was always super sensitive. I was also super hyper. I was telling my friend the other night that I was tired after hosting this like baby shower and stuff at my house from one of my sponsees the other day. She goes, "You get tired?" And it's like, yeah, I do get tired now. But I was high energy. I loved people. I scared kids away. I used to scare my next door neighbor under the coffee table at age 5. I just wanted friends, and I just wanted to belong. And at 5 years old, my parents relocated from Wisconsin to California, and I just didn't fit in for whatever reason. I tried really hard. I got bullied in 5th grade. I changed schools. My mom changed middle schools. I hid in the library my freshman year of high school because all my friends went to Catholic schools, and I just wanted to belong. I also had a theater background, so I could get on stage and be someone else and be comfortable and memorize lines, but I wasn't comfortable standing in front of a classroom talking. or doing anything like this for this matter. And, you know, I just wanted to belong. I wanted to, my goals in high school was get a boyfriend, be popular, you know, and belong. And so finally, that was the reason I picked up the first drink. I was at a cast party. I was worried about the alcohol. Was I going to get too drunk, like my aunt or my next door neighbor? So I diluted it with even more 7-Up, and it really didn't do anything to me. And then the next time I got asked to go to a football game with a bunch of young girls when I was, 15, 16, and they had a big, huge jug of, I think it was Boone's Farm or something that you screw off the top, you mean high-class alcohol. I drank it. It tasted terrible, but I was with a bunch of friends. I was accepted. You know, it went in and was like, it's just like, all I can say is it just took the edge off, and all of a sudden I was a part of, and I was relaxed. I could flirt with boys at the football game. You know, I had this host of friends, and you know, I wasn't one of those alcoholics. I hear some stories where some people pick up a drink and then they black out that first night. They black out, they throw up, they make a fool of themselves. That wasn't me. My alcoholism was progressive. And it was really hard for me when I was 23 to really take the first step and really believe that I belonged here. Even though I raised my hand here for like my first 4 months of sobriety saying I was an alcoholic, I truly didn't believe it. I thought maybe I was a little bit different. Maybe I wasn't as bad as you. Because I always had friends that drank more than I did. Or the same, whatever. I was a little delusional. But when I started doing a written first step with my sponsor and started really looking at that first step, I was the only one in high school that would stand in front of the deli or the supermarket and ask strangers to buy alcohol for us. Because I was the only one that couldn't imagine a Friday or Saturday night without alcohol. And then soon enough, with my acting background, because in California you have everything, and like when we moved out east, like you can only buy liquor at certain places, and like that was like weird. You want to really piss off an alcoholic. We did a geographic, three of us, and drove to Colorado, and all the beer stores were closed on Sundays, and we couldn't get drinks, so we went to this one bar, and all we could get, I don't know, some low percentage stuff. We're like, I'm not gonna talk about what I would say it was, type of water, since we're being recorded. But anyway, it was terrible. But you know, you want to make an alcoholic mad, try to take away their good alcohol from them, and they can't get it. It's not a pretty picture. But I was the only one that was willing to stand up and ask strangers to buy it for me. Or I tried to get super dressed up and with my cigarette in hand, and then they weren't that tight about selling alcohol, and I would buy alcohol for my friends. And I ended up picking the college that I went to based on it being a party school. My mom wanted me to go to a more, kind of uppity private school, which we couldn't even afford at the time. And then I went up to this Cal State Chico, which later was rated number one party school by Playboy magazine for many years. I went up there. I saw this dorm called the Zoo. Everyone was wild and having fun. I'm like, this is where I'm going to go to college. So that's how I picked my college. I didn't have a major. I changed my major like 5 times. I wasn't interested in the whole fraternal or sorority system. But then one of my girlfriends said, there's this one sorority called the Wild Women of Omega Chi. And they don't pick you. You pick them. And their rush week isn't tea and crumpets and them interviewing you. Their rush week is free beers and fraternity boys. I'm like, I'm going to go check out that rush week. And I ended up pledging that sorority. And they were called the Wild Women of Omega Chi. We had no house rules. Anything went in our sorority house, and everything went in our sorority house. And they taught me how to chug tequila. They taught me how to do all sorts of things. And that was my party group. That was my party group through college. And so when I was in college, I wasn't a bad student. I didn't flunk out of any classes. I did pretty well. I was going along, you know, partying like everyone else was. I didn't think I was that different. My junior year, things started to go downhill in various ways in my life, and it was more of a mental downhill. And two of my friends said, hey, you want to go drop out of college mid-semester and like drive to Vail? We have a friend in Colorado, the ski resort, and get us jobs there. And I was like, you know, didn't ask my parents, just hopped in the car. We partied all night long, drank, did other things, and he had a gun, threw it in the back of his car, and we drove to Colorado. And it was like that's kind of crazy. Got jobs out there, came back and told, you know, my parents I'm dropping out of college and moving to Colorado for a season. And so that was George, Indiana, and me. And then later, three of my other sorority sisters came out to join us, and we were out there for the whole season. Now, out of that group of people, Deanna was shot and killed when she was 23 years old, 2 months before I got sober. Lulu is still alive. She's still out in Vail. Trisha's house burned down, and she died because she was drinking and smoking. And Lisa was an alcoholic addict and committed suicide after her son overdosed. So there's only a couple of us that are still alive out of that group. And I got chills right now because, but for the grace of God, there could have gone I, you know. And when I start doubting that I'm an alcoholic and that I don't belong here, it's like I have to remember that I'm one of the lucky ones that gets to be alive. And I'm one of the lucky ones. You know, I was sitting on the couch with Amy before and I'm like, oh my God, time change. It's going to feel like 9 o'clock when I start talking and I'm going to drive all the way to Quakertown. And, you know, it's like, you know, you don't say no to an AA request. And it's like, you know, I get to be here. This is an honor and a privilege to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So, you know, I tried different geographics. You know, I moved to Colorado. Colorado got really bad. I got into the same trouble in Colorado that I got to in California. So what do you do with an alcoholic? You move someplace else and move back and go to school. You know, I don't want to waitress the rest of my life. You know, I want a degree. So I go back to school and you know, it just gets crazier. It just gets crazier and my friends get rougher and my friends get more wild and so do I. And it's a downhill slope. And, you know, there was a gentleman that I knew in college, Tom, and I had heard that he had overdosed and almost died of alcoholism and drugs, and that he was sober and he wasn't drinking anymore. And I'd known him since I was a freshman. So I watched him. I watched him for a full year to see, is this guy really going to stay sober? Is he going to pick up a drink? He was in a fraternity. He was dating another gal that I knew. And I would see him at parties or get-togethers, and I would avoid him. So I think inside, I knew that he knew that I knew that I had a problem with alcohol. It was like, it wasn't something I thought of, but I can look back now and look at that. And so, you know, in a drunken stupor, almost a year later, my girlfriend and I, my girlfriend was dating his roommate, and we were going to spy on him because she thought he was cheating on her, which he was. And I always say this because I don't remember any conversation from the entire night. I just remember we were drunk and we were riding bicycles because we didn't have cars, thank God. And we stopped by their apartment, and Tom was studying. So I was talking to him, and I said, how did you quit drinking and doing drugs? And he said, the hardest thing I ever did was to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was the best thing I ever did. So I just kind of shelved that. I didn't get sober right away. I had to try one more geographic. I figured the last summer before I graduated, if I moved home with mom and dad, I wouldn't get into trouble. And that would curb everything. And I was a barfly, so I was out every night. I was working at a bar. You know, like I said, lots of drinking, other substances. They called me Wild Thing. I'd be dancing on the bar. You know, I was just, you know, crazy. But having fun, telling myself I was having fun. But I started kind of dying inside. And I moved home that summer with mom and dad. And the first weekend home, I went out with old high school friends. And I wasn't going to drink hardly anything. And I wasn't going to do any other substances. And I ended up at one of the biggest dealer's houses in the area by accident. And then I showed up at my girlfriend's house the next morning at 6 in the morning screaming at her for more alcohol and more substances. And she looked at me, and I got to see her a couple of years ago for a 40th high school reunion. I got to thank her. I said, thank you for telling me the truth. And she said, Andrea, I think you have a problem. And a week and a half later, my best friend was shot and killed in Southern California by a police officer. And at that point, that was such a huge shift in my life. Like, oh my gosh, that could have been me. I can't believe this is happening. So I decided I was going to give up smoking and this other substance and take up running. And there was a new fellowship at the time in 1984 in California. And I started going to that fellowship. And I'm only going to talk about AA here. But what I would do is I'd go to that fellowship on Friday nights, and then I would go out drinking afterwards. And I was going to take that whole summer, and I was going to prove to myself I was non-alcoholic. And I tried like that more about alcoholism in the big book, all the different ways we tried to prove that we're non-alcoholic. I tried all those, pretty much all those. And it didn't work. It didn't work. And I went to visit a friend in Southern California at the end of the summer for a little mini vacation. and, you know, went out on a roaring bender. I was with a bunch of rich, pretty girls from SoCal that night. It was a bachelorette party, and they were overcharging for the drinks in the Chippendale stripping bar. And I thought, this is too much money for a drink. And, you know, I wasn't really interested in these guys. And the limo drivers have free alcohol in the car. And I look outside, and they're all partying in the parking lot. Well, I'm not dumb. So I said, forget the Chippendale's bar. I'm going out with the limo drivers, and my limo driver's kind of cute. And it was like free alcohol. And so, you know, a couple hours later, I'm smashed and smoking and doing all the things I said I wasn't going to do again. And my girlfriend and the rest of the gals came out, and I humiliated her and humiliated myself. But luckily, her brother was 2 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, if you're going to be down here for the week, why don't you try some AA meetings? We're a little bit different than your other meetings, but why don't you try some AA meetings? And I went to three with him. And the second one, I heard someone tell my story, only she went 10 years beyond where I had been. So I got to hear of all the yets that could happen to me, because I was like too young. I didn't have a DUI. Well, I didn't have a car. You know, I hadn't done this. I was still getting good grades in college. I was going to be graduating soon. Blah, 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 blah. All the garbage that goes through our heads. And then he took me to a Friday Young People's meeting. And I got to see a lot of people that were my age and younger that were sober and happy in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's when I decided to come to AA. And my last semester sober in college, I didn't have a car. There was only two girls my age sober. So I had to, I was telling Amy on the drive up, my first meeting, I went in there and, you know, the minute I was an alcoholic, and all the women, you know, it was a little old motel that they converted, into an, like a little AA Lano club. And all the women surrounded me and said, stay away from that guy, that guy, and that guy. You know, cause I had my tight blue jeans and my high boots on and tons of makeup and pooped up 80s hair. And, you know, I was always like the drink in one hand and the cigarette in the other. You know, that was all my pictures from college were like that. Thank God we didn't have phones. Thank God we didn't have cell phones or videos back then. Oh my gosh. I actually got in trouble by the president of my sorority because I was drunk and making out with some guy in the front of a fraternity porch at a fraternity sorority social. And I was like, really? Like, you girls all do this? They're like, yeah, but not in public. You know, if we don't display ourselves all over the front porch. So, you know, talk about pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. You know, that was not the woman I wanted to be. That was not the life I wanted to lead. That was not who I wanted to be. And so I was grateful for the women of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was told that women stick with women and men stick with men. I was told 90 meetings in 90 days. I was told get a commitment. We had coffee cups and ashtrays back then. You could smoke in all the meetings. And I had to clean ashtrays and wash coffee cups. And I was scared. I did not want to drink. I was bartending still my first week of sobriety. I almost drank, and I quit my job. I had all sorts of party people all around me in my apartment complex, but I didn't want to drink. I didn't want to drink, so I did what you told me to do. And I basically stayed dry. My first 4 months of sobriety, I got a sponsor. My four-step was like 3 pages long. I lied by omission by about 25 pages. I really didn't think I was an alcoholic. I really hadn't taken that first step, and it wasn't until I moved back home when I graduated, I hit another emotional bottom. I was lucky enough to move back with my mom and dad so I could save money to buy a car and move out and get a job. And I became suicidal at 4 or 5 months sober. And I was going to these meetings, and I'm like, I'm going to these meetings, but I'm not feeling better, and I'm not drinking. You know, and the big book talks about that place where the person alcoholic gets, where they're not happy sober and they're not happy drunk. Like, what are you supposed to do? So I said, okay, if there's really a God, I'm going to get on my knees, and I'm going to ask God to put someone in my life with guidance and direction. And I always say, be careful what you pray for, because if you pray for something specific, it'll be given to you. And the next night, even one of the best gifts AA taught me is you suit up and show up no matter what. No matter what. You just go. And so I knew I had gotten that in my head, so I didn't really want to go to a meeting, but I don't want to stay home with mom and dad, so I went. And I stood in the back of the room, and I was just like morose. And this lady came up to me and said, hi, my name's Barbara. Gave me her phone number, asked me to go to coffee afterwards. And then later that evening, I asked her to sponsor me. And then I found out the next day that her handle, they had handles back in California, was Big Book Barbara. And I picked probably the biggest person in Marin County that would give me guidance and direction. And she scared me so badly. But she hooked me up with her other sponsees, and we were supposed to call each other and give each other rides. And one other gal named Lisa, I couldn't stand, she couldn't stand me, but I didn't have a car, and we were stuck together, and we are still really, 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 really close friends. We talk on a regular basis, and we're both still sober, and so I'm grateful. We lost track of Barbara. We don't know where Barbara ended up, but we're still sober today, so I'm grateful for that. But she gave me such a good foundation of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that's so important. If you're new, I want to welcome the new people here. You know, make sure you get a sponsor. Make sure you get to lots of meetings. Make sure you get commitments. Make sure you say yes to reading things, even though you're nervous in front of the meeting. You know, get involved. Go to different meetings. It's so, so important to set up that foundation. Because what happens when, like, I, you know, just gave up my number to a new person the other night, and I was explaining to her, you have to call these people. Don't just text. You have to call these people on a regular basis, because if you feel like picking up a drink, you're not going to pick up the phone and call me. If you've never called me before, you're just not going to do that. You know, you just pick up the phone and say, hey, I'm making that stupid call you told me to make. This is Andrea. I'm a newcomer. Like, and it goes really easy. We all did it. And so, you know, that's just so important to get that AA foundation. And I'm really grateful because Barbara took me through the steps of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we went through paragraph by paragraph, step by step. And I get asked questions, and she told me to underline things. And that the Big Book I have today now, someone gave me this idea in California recently. I like the bigger print, but I don't use my first Big Book because it's so marked up with lines and highlights. So I have when my Big Book study, my home group is the Fogelsville Big Book study in Fogelsville at 7:30 on Wednesdays if you ever want to come. But I like to use a blank book, and then I like the bigger print. And I got this done at Staples. You can just flip it over so it lays flat on the table now. I like to read it with no underlines now because at 38 years sober, I have a different experience with this than I did at 1 year sober. And this book is so divinely inspired that there's times that I'll read that and I'll go, I never saw that before. Or whatever I'm going through at age 61 is very different than when I was going through at age 25. Whatever it is in my life, you know, and I have different experience and different wisdom than I had then. And I realize I know less in some ways and I know more in some ways based on my personal experience. And that's the thing about this program. It's a recipe. It's experiential. I can't just, like read these. I remember reading the steps on the wall and I was, you know, I'm like, oh, I'll do that one. No, I don't want to do that one. Definitely not doing that one. You know, maybe I'll do that one. And I also had a thing with a higher power. I was raised atheist. So I had a real problem with the higher power thing because I don't want to be shaved heads, togas, and San Francisco passing out carnations. You know, my parents warned me about people like you that talked about God. So that was another kind of, problem I had to get through. So I used my deceased best friend, Deanna. I used her. It says in the Good Book, it talks about a power greater than ourselves. You know, it talks about a newfound friend, you know, so that's what I used in the beginning. And today my higher power is a loving, all-powerful, guiding force, you know, and that's what works for me. And I've spent years nourishing that power greater than myself. And the way I had the spiritual awakening was the result of these steps. I don't get it in step three. Step three is just like opening the door, right? My sponsor says like making a decision. So what's the decision to go along with the rest of the steps? And, you know, if I make a decision to go to Europe, I don't end up in Europe. I've got to earn the money, get a job, buy the ticket, get an airplane, and fly over there. So if I want that spiritual experience, I've got to do all these steps in between. And the biggest thing for me was looking at how selfish I was and how I was running the show, because I thought I was unselfish. And when I read you know, the third step in the big book, and it talked about the million forms of self-centeredness, self-pity. Well, that's selfish. I didn't think self-pity was selfish. You know, that I could be kind and sweet, and like I always, the new thing that came up this last year is when I want my husband to do something, I'll say, would you do this real quick? And he'll go, oh, real quick? You know, so in other words, it doesn't take much effort on his part, you know? So just noticing even little nuances that I do now to be selfish, to get my way. And the whole idea of asking God in the morning to direct my thinking to what I can be to help other people. And that it's not all about me. And eventually taking a fourth step. And I was afraid to death to take a fourth step. And it was one of the most liberating things I've ever done. And because it showed me patterns that I had repeated for my entire life. And I was always the victim. And so all this time I'm pointing the finger at everybody else and I never looked at me. And so that was an amazing, amazing thing for me. And I, you know, I thought I would shock my sponsor and she almost fell asleep. So, and that was like my first glimmer of hope, you know, the day after my fifth step, was I felt a sense of freedom. And I remember this man in AA, I was a coffee maker at this big Sunday morning meeting, and he said to me, he said, you did your fifth step recently, didn't you? I said, how can you tell? He goes, you just have a different air about you. You know, I think there's a lightness about us. You know, the same, I found the same thing with step nine. Once I started making amends to people, you know, there was more of a freedom. I heard a speaker once say, how free do you want to be? Are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober? And what do those any lengths look like? What do they look like? I don't want to drink again. I have so much in my life now, you know, with my family, with my friends. Like, I don't want to lose that. It's not the stuff. You know, I don't care about the stuff. Well, some of the stuff's nice. Okay, so, but it's more the peace of mind I have. Because like all through my drinking, I was searching for that peace of mind that I would get from alcohol. Then you take the alcohol away, you take whatever substance you're addicted away, and then all of a sudden you're left with this hole, and like the 12 steps fill that hole up. And, you know, bringing God into it. And I look at the steps and it's like, when you look at them more deeply, it's like a prayer and then action. And you're praying before step three and then you're looking at your inventory and then you're praying before you look at your fourth column. And then you're looking at the fears and then you're praying to have God show you who you should be instead. And then you're looking at your sex inventory and then you're looking again at asking God to shape a sane and sound ideal of how you should be in relationships. So it's like a prayer action, and you know, I just love that. And you know, someone was reading the promises on one of the Zoom meetings I go to, a woman's Zoom meeting, and I was a tech person that day, and she said, can you show up, pull up the promises? I'm like, well, which ones? You know, she goes, the promises. I said, well, there's promises after every step. You know, and everyone always forgets about the 10-step promises that we'll be able to recoil us from a hot flame. Like, I came in here because I didn't want to drink. That's why I thought I came in here. You know, but I got so much more because I don't have to pick up a drink today. And, you know, the other thing I want to talk about is step 11, too. I was, like, hyperactive. I couldn't sit still. This whole meditating thing was, like, I could do walking meditation, you know, and there's so many different ways you can figure that out. But I was at a retreat, 11-step retreat with Joe Hawk years ago in New Jersey, and he said, if you are in a relationship and you want to get close to that person, you have to spend time with them. Like, you know, if you're just saying prayers in the bathroom, in the shower, in the potty, in the car, whatever, you know, that's not giving God the time that God deserves. How are you supposed to build a relationship with a higher power if you're not spending time with that higher power? So, you know, I have my prayer and meditation. I've done all sorts of different you know, meditation workshops, you know, from different, you know, Buddhism, all sorts of stuff. I guess I'm kind of a cafeteria person, that way they call it. You know, I figure whatever gets me closer to God, I'll try it. You know, and whatever deepens my spirituality and helps me be still with God and hear that quiet voice inside, I will try it and see if it fits for me. And so even my prayer and meditation books have changed over the years. But I do. I take that quiet every morning. Now I have a cat I got during COVID, and she'll crawl up on my lap and she'll just sit there while I meditate. And that's pretty neat. And my husband joins me for morning meditation when he's home. He's an airline pilot, so he's not always home. So I met him when I was 5 years sober, and we first started dating. You know, I told him I was a recovered alcoholic, and that kind of freaked him out. looking at the time here. And that kind of freaked him out. Like, what does that mean? You know, so I took him to AA meetings. I took him to, I was involved with, ICKYPAW at the time in California. So I took him to ICKYPAW conferences. I took him to all California conferences. And I explained to him, you know, if we're going to get serious, you need to know that Alcoholics Anonymous is going to be part of my life for the rest of my life. And I sponsor women, and that means that they're going to call, or they might show up, or we're going to be interrupted. So, are you going to be okay with that? And I told him, I said, my sobriety has to come first, because if I'm not sober, then I can't be there for you or anybody else. And, like I said, we met in, was it March of 1989, and we've been together ever since, and he's been so supportive. I had this big shower for a gal, not big shower, but like 7 or 8 of us, for a gal I've been sponsoring for 7 years, who's having her second baby, and she couldn't have a baby shower because of COVID with the first one. So he spent all morning, Saturday morning, helping me set up for the shower, and then he came back and helped me clean up later. You know, I've never been to an international women's conference. I went to Santa Fe last year and met some of my California friends and brought some of my friends here and a friend from Jersey. And it was Valentine's weekend. And he's like, go, whatever you need to do. We can celebrate whenever. So I think that's so important. And I want to touch on the 12th step too, is that, like I said, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message. So it's not my message. It's a message of recovery. On how I got sober, that the alcoholics put in this little textbook here, and to practice these principles in all my affairs. And so, like, I can stand in an AA meeting, and I can look good, I can sound good, I can memorize the book, but if I walk out the door, and I'm flipping off the person on the highway, or I'm screaming at my kids when I walk in the door, or, you know, whatever, then I'm not really practicing these principles in all my affairs. You know, I hear people call it the forgotten chapters in the big book, you know, to the employers, family afterwards, to the wives, vision for you. You know, those are all chapters on how to practice these principles in all your affairs. And, so I had to learn through AA. I watched my sponsor. My first sponsor said, watch my feet. I didn't know what that meant. It meant watch what I do, not what I say. And I watched how the women sponsored other women in AA, and they said, here, Andrea, here's this woman, you're giving her a ride home tonight. And I'm like, what? I want to go to a coffee shop, and there's a cute guy over there. She goes, nope, you're giving Megan a ride home, and then you can give her rides to meetings all week. People do that for you. You know, so I had like this heavy, loving coaching, I guess you could say. But I didn't know how to be in relationships when I was newly sober, and so I learned how to love unconditionally by sponsoring other women in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the first time my sponsor started helping me, I bought her a bouquet of flowers, and she didn't want the flowers. And I was so hurt. And she said, no, I want you to freely give away what was freely given to you. So don't buy me flowers. I'm not charging you for gas the whole first year. When you get a car, you don't charge the new gals for gas. You just take them. I had an amend I could not make. I could not reach. I put money aside into a savings account. And then I started sponsoring a gal years ago that was a single mom and had a little kid. And I took her to a conference for a weekend. We drove 2.5 hours down, and her dad watched his grandson. And I paid for the conference, and I paid for her meals, and I paid for the gas. And that was a way to use the amends money. And we're still close friends today as well. So I learned how to get on myself. I learned how to make amends to my parents, not by just making amends to them, but helping them do stuff around the house. When I spoke here last, it's coming up on the anniversary of my father's death. It was November 12th, 2017, and I never thought it would be so hard to lose a parent. And I was kind of a mess when I came here last time, but I look back now, and it's like, I got to do that sober. I flew back and forth to California. I was in California almost 13 weeks that year, back and forth, helping my mom, helping my dad, because I was sober. I was able to deal with the doctors. I was able to deal with hospice. Did I do the best job I could have done? Probably not, but I was sober. I did the best job I could do. And I got to spend time with my dad that year before he passed away. I've had several friends in Alcoholics Anonymous that have died sober of cancer. I've got to be there for them. I've got to show up at the hospitals. I got to be there for their families. I've made all my amends to people that I have harmed. I have one or two out there I don't know how to reach, But I'm ready and willing if they show up in my pathway, to make amends to them. You know, I watched the women in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they showed me how to be a woman of dignity and grace and to show up and reach my hand out. When I was new, people found me. Big Book Barbara found me in the back of the room. And I was hiding in the back of the room. I was dying inside, even though I looked okay on the outside. And so I always try to look for the new person. And I always talk about this because once we're in AA for a while, we, like, have friends, and we see our friends, and we kind of, like, not really click up, but kind of click up with them. And it's like, you know, I'm always looking for that new person. You know, people always make fun of me in my home group because they say, oh yeah, Andrea's going to chase you out of the meeting. Like, if I see someone leave the meeting early, you know, I'll run after them, give them my phone number, a phone list, and now everything's on apps. You know, a big book, you know, I want everyone to feel welcome in Alcoholics Anonymous. I know that this is a fatal disease. Like I said, I have several friends that have died of alcoholism. I've been in AA long enough that I've seen people commit suicide. I've seen people die of alcoholism. I've seen people overdose. You know, I know this is a fatal disease. I do not want to die of alcoholism, and I do not want to drink again. So I'm, like, willing to go to any lengths to stay sober today. And I think, too, one of the things I found was, like, when you're new in sobriety, you're all kind of jazzed up, and we used to call them the terrible twos in California, because you'd be all excited, and you've had your first spiritual awakening, and you want to go help everybody. And I think I was about 17 years sober when I went to that Joe Hawk retreat in New Jersey. So my husband's an airline pilot. We moved from California to New Jersey. We was in New Jersey for a year and a half, and Colorado for 3.5 years, and we've been here 28 years now, I think it is, in Pennsylvania. And that was really hard to move, too, because when you move in sobriety, you're not a newcomer anymore. You know, and you have to find a sponsor again. It takes time. A little culture shock coming from the West Coast to the East Coast. There weren't any big study meetings west of Bethlehem. I met this man, Rhubarb Jim, I think, that used to come here. And he used to come to my Focus on Big Book group for years. But I met him at a big study when I first moved to the Allentown, Bethlehem area. And so I met this one guy, Johnny Halpin and Todd Rodenzel, and I had known one of them through Icky Pox. I had been on the Icky Pox Big Committee for 5 years in California and met people from all over the United States. And I said, there's no Big Book study meetings, like west of Bethlehem. So the three of us started the Big Book study meeting in Bowlesville. And they said, there's a new girl that lives up the road from you. She makes coffee on Tuesday night. Go grab her. And, so that little meeting started, we just had our anniversary, October 25th, 1995. We started with four of us. And we did get up to like 45, 50, and then COVID hit, and now we're anywhere between 9 and 20. But it doesn't matter. Like, the core people are there. You know, the core people are there, and we read a paragraph or two, and we share our experience, drink, and hope on that. And we love each other, and we care about each other, and we're there for each other. And, you know, it's an amazing thing. This Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been to meetings in Iceland. I've had opportunity to travel because my husband's a pilot. So I've been to meetings in Iceland. I've been to meetings on a cruise ship. I've been to meetings in campgrounds. I've been to meetings in Italy. And so that's the coolest thing. I stumbled on a meeting at a beach in Punta Cana years ago. I was at an all-inclusive, and it was one of the first times I thought about drinking. And there was this beautiful glass of pink Chablis. It was an all-inclusive. And I went back to the room, and I had my AA book, and I was reading, and I was praying. And I'm like, and we didn't have social media or apps back then to find the meetings. So I was just praying, taking a walk on the beach the next morning, and there was a group of people sitting in a circle. So we asked God for help. Help shows up. Group of people sitting in a circle, and they're listening to a cassette tape. How did that? And I recognize a voice. It's Clancy I from the Pacific Group in Southern California. I said, excuse me, are you having an AA meeting? And they're like, click. They're like, yes, how do you know? And I said, I'm an alcoholic, I need a meeting. So I ended up, they were just a family. They were there for one, and they were meeting every morning. So, you know, you ask God for help, and there they were every morning. So life hasn't always been easy in sobriety. for anybody, including me. I've had ups and downs in my sobriety. The biggest down I had was, I was sharing with Amy earlier. We had dinner before we came down here. I had a pretty severe long-haul COVID that affected me physically and mentally and emotionally, and they didn't know what it was at the time, and it was like an alien almost took over my brain. It was pretty terrifying. It took like 7 months for me to get back to who Andrea was. It was terrifying. I had A, friends over all the time. My husband, supporting my husband, my friends, nobody could figure out. Brain MRIs, I had all the tests you can imagine. And eventually with a bunch of different things, it subsided. But I was terrified. But I still got on my Zoom meetings every single night. I didn't want to. I'd get off the Zoom meetings and I would cry because I felt like I lost my connection to my higher power. I would just cry, like, what is happening to me? I would pray to God. One of my closest friends in AA's, four-year-old daughter in December 2020 was diagnosed with brain cancer. And all I could do was ask God, why is this happening to Belzy? Why is this happening to me? Like, I've done everything. I've done all this. I do all this. I work hard at this. Like, there's no guarantees just because I work these steps. You know, we tried to road to happy destiny. There's no guarantee that life is going to be good and it's going to be happy. But, you know, I've gone through my times in sobriety where I've, like, doubted God. Like, you know, what? I'm like, my God, I swear at my God sometimes. And my God loves me no matter what, just like I love my kids. If they were to swear at me, I might punish them, but I still love them. That was a really dark, you know, they talk about the dark night of the soul and some different religions and stuff like that. But I kept coming back, and my AA friends and the women I sponsored carried me. They carried me. And I didn't give up because I knew somewhere in the back of my brain, I've been so trained in AA to not to give up and to keep coming back no matter what. And with a lot of help and a lot of support and a lot of outside help, I was able to come out the other side. And every day I wake up and it was like, I'm just so grateful that you guys gave me tools, you know, tools to live and tools to reach out and say, hey, you know, just because I'm sober a long time doesn't mean I don't suffer. I need help. You know, and I think sometimes when they wrote our textbook, you know, the early people in sobriety, they weren't sober very long. What, 4 or 5 years, if some of that? You know, and there's a lot of people with a lot of time in sobriety, and, you know, things have changed. So, you know, looking at ways to reconnect with each other, and, you know, it's okay to go through dark spots in your life. Be honest, telling yourself, tell people, you know, I was told you're only as sick as your secrets. You know, and people can't help me unless I ask for help. So I don't want to ever get so big on my high horse with, you know, sobriety. You know, I don't look at long-term sobriety. Yeah, you might have experience, but I'm just another drunk like you. I'm just another drunk trying to live life on life's terms and just trying maybe a little bit more years experience picking up. But, you know, we can easily get pulled off the path, you know, and that's why I love AA meetings because it keeps me on the path. You know, that's why I love sponsoring people. It keeps me on the path. You know, I have women I sponsor. My sponsor relocated to the West Coast. We Zoom on Tuesday nights. Thank goodness for Zoom. And that was the coolest thing too, because when COVID hit, like boom, we were all like I'm not technical at all. Now I'm a tech person for a Zoom meeting for the women at 10:30 in the morning during the week. And like we just flipped right over. Like AA knew what to do. We knew what to do. We knew we had to stay connected, whether by phone or Zoom or whatever, or outside meetings. And I just think that's so awesome. So, I'm grateful for sobriety. I'm grateful for all of you. If you're new and you're scared and you want to drink, keep coming back. Grab somebody next to you. Tell them, I want to drink. If you're sober a long time and you want to drink and you're scared and you feel like you're falling apart, grab someone and tell them. You know, we're just all drunks trying to stay sober one day at a time. Nobody's any better or worse than anybody else. You know, I hate it when people put people on pedestals. I put some circuit speakers on pedestals when I was younger in recovery. They're like movie stars to me. They're just another drunk. They're just another human being sharing their experience, strength, and hope. I always like to end with the last two paragraphs from the Big Book and A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask God in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man or woman who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with God is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is a great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to God and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you.